Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. We're very blessed to have with us David Seeloff. We are beginning today file number 18 in the series on 101 Bible Secrets. And today we will begin going through the appendices of that book, 101 Bible Secrets. And you can read this book free online at askelm.com, askelm.com. The ELM stands for Ernest L. Martin. David Seeloff is the Director of Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and he carries on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin. You can email David at this address. Very easy. David@askelm.com. And with that, we will begin file number 18 now with David Seeloff on 101 Bible Secrets. Hi, David.
Hi, Georgianne. It's always a joy.
Yeah, it is. I really like this time with you. It's very educational and very uplifting.
Well, it's always fun to learn. My wife has that feeling that she always enjoys learning new stuff. And not everybody does, but I do, and she does, and so do you, I know. And, you know, we forget that actually the most important thing is to learn is about God and His Word and what He has to teach us, because to a certain extent, the Scriptures literally are the thoughts of God's mind coming into our minds.
Right.
And when we think of it that way, you know, we complain that God doesn't, you know, if God would just communicate, if I really knew that He was there. Well, if you study enough of the Scripture, you come to understand that He has communicated with mankind through Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And He now uses the avenue of the written word to communicate His message to us, His message of salvation, as well as history and how mankind living without God has not worked.
Right.
And the Israelites are a microcosm of mankind through history. And He's chosen to tell their narrative through His Word to use them as examples, good and bad, of all mankind, both corporately, individual nations, some of which have ceased to exist and some which have continued to today, as well as individually. There are some who think that certain stories within Scripture actually relate to individuals in terms of, you know, through growth stages. And we might find out more about that as we learn more from Scripture, or certainly in the resurrection. We might be surprised to what extent Dr. Martin has likened the law and then the prophets and then the writings as developmental stages of education. And then you have the New Testament, which of course is focused and centered on Jesus Christ. And then up to Revelation, which is the college education, the final theoretical education, all the way from, you know, the Gospels and then the Catholic epistles and then the Pauline epistles with their sophistication and developed theology, and then the book of Revelation. Well, those growth stages, each individual will have to go through those growth stages and learn the lessons in each stage. Well, in the Torah, the law, the first five books of Moses, it tells the story of Israel and the Exodus. And one of the major miraculous events that occurred in that whole Exodus event in the Torah was the crossing of the Red Sea. It indicated a passage out of one type of life into another for Israel. And I don't want to get too far afield in terms of application to an individual. But the Appendix 1 in Dr. Martin's book that he wrote, 101 Bible Secrets, and of course we're essentially covering or reading the book as we go along. The first appendix is that Dr. Martin felt that he had to expand on the topic of crossing the Red Sea, which in earlier Bible secrets he denoted, he has actually discovered that they crossed the Red Sea on a bridge of ice. And this is Bible secret number 4, page 18 on the book. And Dr. Martin says, to many people, the crossing of the Red Sea on top of an ice bridge seems totally absurd. Where in all history has anyone ever made a suggestion? And in truth, Dr. Martin says that he doesn't know of any such suggestion. So this idea of Israel crossing on a bridge of ice is actually unique to him, to Dr. Martin. And the first time he studied the account, 38 years ago, the Bible said to me that it was on an ice bridge. But then he asks the question, but wait, does not the text say that Israel went across on, quote, dry land or, quote, dry ground? And actually, again, Hollywood is wrong in the depictions. In the 1920s, they made a movie called The Exodus, and then it was redone in the 1950s. With Charlton Heston, and both were epic productions for the time. But they showed what the common thought was of theologians, and it was actually wrong in terms of what the Bible says. The text of Scripture does not say that the Israelites went across on dry land or dry ground, even though at first glance a person might be led to that conclusion. And this is in Exodus chapter 14, verses 21 to 22, verse 29, and also Exodus chapter 15, verse 19. But note carefully that the King James word for land or ground is in italics in all those instances. And that this means actually that those italicized words are not in the biblical text. They were inserted for clarification by the translators. What this means is that the Israelites walked dry shod. That's the actual, in some instance, on some type of substance that was itself dry. Now, the context identifies that, quote, dry substance, end quote. And in the case of crossing the Red Sea, Dr. Martin maintains that it was ice and not land or ground. The Israelites went across on a thick and wide slab of ice, which, of course, as we know, you can get from icebergs, you can get some huge structures made out of ice. Now, does not the text say that the waters were a wall on each side of the pathway? This is in Exodus chapter 14 verses 22 and verse 29. Yes, in fact, the waters were likened by Moses as two walls of water on each side. But he did not mean that the walls were like the sides of a canyon with the Israelites in the valley below, on the bottom of the seabed. Not at all. There is a principle that must be followed if one hopes to interpret the Bible in a proper way. That principle is to let God give the definition of the Hebrew or Greek words that he uses to explain himself to readers in Scripture. And he does such a thing with this use of the word wall, which in Hebrew is pronounced gomah. G-H-O-H-M-A-H, Goma, in the matter of the Exodus. In the book of Nahum, the same word wall, Goma, is used in another context that also fits what happened in the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, here's what the prophet Nahum wrote to describe the island city of Thebes in Egypt, which had the waters of the Nile surrounding her. Nahum said, quote, "Are you better than Thebes, situated, are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile with water around her? The river," meaning the Nile, "was her defense, and the water was her wall." Goma, and this is in Nahum, chapter 3, verse 8, from the New International Version. So, just like in Nahum, Moses used the same word wall, goma, to signify the open waters on each side of the ice bridge, which were like walls to the Israelites. Those walls were not at all perpendicular ones like the sides of a canyon. And as far as the word dividing, which in Hebrew is bakag, the waters, as far as the word dividing the waters is concerned, bakag, in other parts of the Bible, the same word dividing simply means to separate one section of the subject under discussion from another, like breaching a wall of a house or a city. For example, 2 Chronicles 21:17 or Jeremiah 52, verse 7. Or dividing one part of an army from another, as it is used in 1 Chronicles 11:18. Indeed, the ice bridge did in fact separate one part of the Red Sea from the other, as the word bakag signifies. Now, what God did at the Exodus was to cause, in a miraculous way, a cold wind to arise at night, which froze the waters of the Red Sea into an ice bridge, a bridge of ice, which was dry. He froze the water to be like dry land. In the Arctic today, thick ice covers the lakes over which heavy trucks can travel, and the ice is as dry as a bone. I lived in the Midwest, and there were instances in which the lakes were frozen when I was at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. I used to walk across the lake to my classes when, and it was very dry in many of those instances. I mean, the humidity was very, very low in many of those places. Now, we know that, you know, the humidity is very low in the Middle East, especially near Egypt. But, you know, you wonder about, well, what about the heat, and wouldn't that melt the ice and all that stuff? Well, we'll perhaps cover that as we go. But in the case of the Exodus, and remember, most of the water in the Arctic is salt water. So, you know, salt water can freeze also. The ocean water can freeze if conditions are correct, or just so. So it's more difficult for salt water to freeze, but it can be frozen nonetheless.
Well, look up in Alaska, the polar bears, the ice packs, the ice floes out in the ocean. Yes, of course they can freeze.
Yeah. In the case of the Exodus, it was a thick ice bridge that stuck out of the water, about 10% higher than the surrounding waters, which were like walls to the Israelites. So when the morning came and the Israelites were safe, they crossed at night, and the Israelites were safe on the east side, the Egyptians started across the ice bridge. When they got themselves far out on the bridge, the Hebrew of Exodus 14:25 states that the wheels of the Egyptians, the Egyptian chariots, began to slip off the ice bridge. The Egyptian drivers drove the horses heavily forward to keep the chariots from slipping off the sides into the water. This sliding off the ice bridge of the chariots with their men is described by Moses. It says, "The horse and his rider has he thrown into the sea." This is in Exodus chapter 15, verse 1 and verse 21. Now think about this. If they were in the middle of a valley, as portrayed in the movie, in the movies, the Exodus, you know, you're in the middle of this huge canyon.
Yeah.
They weren't thrown into the sea. they show the sea enveloping them. And, you know, Moses said in a similar expression in Exodus chapter 15, verse 4, quote, Pharaoh's chariots and his host has he cast into the sea, end quote. Psalm 136, verse 15 states, quote, but God is the subject here, but God overthrew or shook off Pharaoh and his host in the Red Sea, end quote. You know, that's exactly what happened. They were shaken off into the sea. The book of Hebrews also talks about this. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 29, it states, quote, by faith they, meaning the Israelites, passed through the Red Sea as by dry land. The comparison is being made here to dry land, which the Egyptians, assaying to do or attempting to do, they were drowned. Now, this is the King James translation in which the word land, even in Hebrews, is the word land is in italics. But even retaining the word land is no problem with Paul's meaning because he uses the word as in the text. Now, he means, in other words, as though it were dry land. Even Moses said that Yahweh made the sea dry land. And this is in Exodus chapter 14, verse 21. The sea itself was made solid or converted into something like dry land. Not that Israel walked on the dry sea bottom. In Psalm 66, verse 6, we read that God turned or transferred the sea, quote, turned the sea into dry land, that is, into a dry substance, end quote. The sea itself was converted into a dry substance, not that the sea was opened up and that the Israel walked on the sea bottom. But the sea itself was congealed or made into ice, and this fits the story of the crossing of the Red Sea perfectly. Even Paul said the same thing. I mean, it freezes in Israel and they have snow, so they know what ice is.
Yes.
I mean, you can go on the internet and see pictures of snow on the Dome of the Rock. And anywhere can have snow or ice in any particular time, especially if God is doing it. Remember, Paul said that the substance on their feet, the substance on which their feet trod was just like dry land to them, as though they were on dry land. Then the Apostle Paul remarked, which, in other words, the dry land, that is the substance that had become solid and dry, which the Egyptians made a trial, and that's the Greek word is trial, of walking. But the Red Sea, which Paul personified, swallowed them up. In other words, the Red Sea swallowed them down in the Greek. In other words, the Egyptians went from the surface down to the bottom of the sea as they drowned and sank because they wore armor and the chariots dragged down the horses. The chariots were armored.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult to swim when you have armor.
Well, and you couldn't drive chariots in a mud-filled, you know, I mean, the bottom of the sea is muddy, you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That is, the Egyptians went from the surface down to the bottom. And indeed, Paul is simply quoting Moses. Paul in Hebrews is quoting Moses that, quote, the earth swallowed them and down. In Exodus chapter 15, verse 12. You know, thus everything actually becomes clear regarding the events that happened on that crucial day in biblical history. In the plainest of language, we're told by Moses and Miriam, his sister, that the waters congealed into a frozen slab of ice that made the water to be a solid mass, and they went across it just like on dry ground or dry land. The slab stood upright, as ice in water does, by about 10%, with 90% below. And the Israelites walked across it at night. Now, the Egyptians, during the heat of the day, did not make it across. Well, Dr. Martin asks the question then, well, what about 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 and 2, where Paul said that the Israelites were under the cloud and all passed through the sea and were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea? That's what it says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Well, does this support the supposition of Hollywood after all? This has been a favorite verse of Baptists to show that the word baptized means to immerse or to put under the water. And although this is true, that's what the word means, to them, Paul's analogy indicates that Israel was on the seabed and, figuratively speaking, under the water surface. And this, however, is not the case. Paul's real meaning can easily be understood. And, you know, Dr. Martin says, let me explain this with a story about my early life. He was born in Oklahoma and spent his early years there. The region where they lived was made up mainly of Methodists and Baptists with a prominent predominance of Baptists. Of course, there were other prominent Protestant groups represented, like the Super Methodists, who were called the Nazarenes. And Dr. Martin had two of his uncles who were Nazarene preachers, along with the Campbellites and Pentecostals and a few others. But the Methodists, the Baptists, dominated the area that was common, that it was common to call the Methodists the Army of the Lord and to call the Baptists the Navy of the Lord. The Navy, the Baptists were the Navy because they put people under the water at baptism, while the Methodists normally just sprinkled. And they were called the Army. Now, his father was a Methodist and his mother was a Baptist. And they got along splendidly, but when the subject of baptism came up, the sparks would fly. And Dr. Martin's mother used the argument of most Baptists that complete immersion was correct because Paul, the Apostle Paul said, using the traditional interpretation of the crossing of the Red Sea, that the Israelites went down into the seabed with the water above their heads. And Baptists normally believe that this was the best way to understand Paul's figure of baptism in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 and 2. Well, his father did not feel that the interpretation was correct because he saw that the Israelites went through the sea without any water touching them. It reminded him, he said, of some Baptists he knew whom he claimed were dry, quote, dry sinners, end quote, before their baptism, but were simply wet sinners when they came up out of the water.
I've never heard that one before. That is pretty good. Oh,
they're still sinners. It didn't take, in other words. Yeah. Be that as it may, his mother did not think that his dad's belief defended Methodist sprinkling.
Yeah.
But it did, according to his father. He said that the key to the whole thing was Paul saying that the Israelites were baptized in the cloud as well as in the sea. Mm-hmm. But his mother showed his father that the Israelites were not up in the cloud to get wet from the cloud surrounding them because Paul said that they were under the cloud the whole time they crossed the Red Sea. And this is the very thing that his father wanted his mother to admit. Then he said, quote, being under the cloud is what makes Paul's teaching sensible, because you see, that's when the cloud rained on them and sprinkled them. And with a smile on his face, he said, that makes our Methodist way of sprinkling better than your Baptist way of immersing. In fact, his father wasn't as Dr. Martin says dad wasn't far off because water did come forth from a sapphire stone that was in the shape of a throne in which God sat over the cherubim. And that's question number 100 that we covered earlier.
Yeah.
But his dad got a laugh out of kidding his mother on this matter. And though both of them enjoyed joking with one another over the issue, they still took Paul, the Apostle Paul, very seriously. And they certainly weren't kidding around about Paul's teaching. The truth is that both their father, his father and mother, knew that both their explanations had major drawbacks to them. And But really, when one studies the words that the Apostle Paul used in Greek, this matter can be easily understood. And this was because the word en, E-N, in Greek, in the phrase in the cloud and in the sea, is not always equal in its meaning to our English word, in. It often means by. And Dr. R.C.H. Lenski, the great Lutheran scholar, explains this. Unfortunately, I don't have which, let's see if I have it. Dr. Martin didn't give a source as to where Lenski got this, but, and I haven't been able to source this. But Lenski wrote, and I don't know in what book, quote, being under the cloud and passing through the sea are here termed a baptism, and were analogous to Christian baptism. The proposition N is usually termed instrumental, quote, by the cloud, etc. By this, be conceived as an immersion, insofar as the cloud could cast a shadow over the Israelites, but scarcely in regard to the waters of the sea, which in no way covered the Israelites, who walked through upon dry ground. Only the Egyptians were immersed, and that not only figuratively, but literally. Now, the Egyptians were not baptized by any means. They were killed. As for the cloud, this moved over the Israelites, its function being to separate them from the Egyptians. No water from the cloud or from the sea was applied to the Israelites. It is likewise a function of the sea to separate. End quote. Dr. Lenski, page 390 of some unknown work that Dr. Martin is referring to. The meaning of Paul's illustration is simple. He was showing that the Israelites were baptized unto Moses. They came under and within his full authority by the cloud and by the sea. That is, by the cloud being above them and the sea being beneath them, they were completely surrounded, that is, immersed unto Moses, with the full protection from God, both from above and from below. And this is what Paul meant. The Israelites were certainly not up in the cloud, nor were they down in a trench in the bottom of the sea. They were actually, as we've shown as the true and proper interpretation of the crossing, on top of the waters that had been turned into a solid roadway of ice. And it is by this understanding, by understanding this fact, that Israel was actually on top of the waters, that Paul's figure of being immersed both by the cloud, by the cloud above, as well as by the sea below, it all makes perfectly good sense as to what Paul is trying to say, express here in terms of the symbolism of baptism. All of what Moses said, including the testimony of Paul, shows that the Israelites went through the Red Sea, as shown in questions 4 and 5 in this book, and by means of an ice bridge, which stood up about 10% above the surface of the water. This is precisely what the texts state when you read them carefully. And it's time to give up the Hollywood version and to get back to the original teaching of the Bible. The great rabbinic scholar named Rashi said the waters were made to stand upwards like a stack of wheat or a mound. And it was like one mound, a single mound, but level on top. Not like two ice mounds parallel to each other, stretching across the extent of the sea. And while Israel safely crossed this bridge at night, the ice bridge began to get slippery with the sun coming out and the wheels of the chariots slipping off the ice into the open sea. And as morning progressed, the slab of ice began to break into pieces. The Egyptians found themselves unable to stay on the several pieces of melting ice. Then they were cast off, or they slid off, into the sea. And as Moses and Paul both said, the sea swallowed them down into the waters, or to the depths, and this is the real biblical meaning.
They even found some of those chariot wheels.
Yeah, I find that very interesting and intriguing, and I haven't decided yet in my own mind Anyone can make their own decision. But it, you know, how did those items get there?
Yeah.
Because there's usually when there's a shipwreck, there are other identifiable ship components to indicate that, you know, these items came from a ship, and there apparently aren't any. If there's a reconciliation someday, whether it's through David's tomb or some other means, between the Saudis and the Israel, this whole matter could be cleared up very quickly if Sinai is indeed in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, which is even more of a wilderness than Mount Sinai, actually, what we call Mount Sinai today.
Right.
Because remember, the Egyptians had tin mines and copper mines all up and, I don't know about tin mines, but copper mines, all up and down the western shore of the Sinai Peninsula. Not the shore, but the western land areas of Mount Sinai. It was a wilderness, but it was developing. You know, they were doing mining in that area. The interior was certainly a wilderness, but so is Saudi Arabia.
Oh, yes.
It's even a greater wilderness. And Paul explicitly says, talks about Arabia. Let's see if I can bring that up real quick. Now, I did ask Dr. Martin about this one time, and his idea was that, oh, here it is. Yeah, in Galatians chapter 4, verse 25. And let's see, in the King James Version, it says, "For this Agar is Mount Sinai," or meaning Hagar, "is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and it answers to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children." Paul's discussion in Galatians here is to, you know, the distinction between those who are, you know, of Hagar and those who are of Jerusalem.
Right.
And in those days, there was no difference. But Paul explicitly says that Mount Sinai is in Arabia. And it's, you know, he says that explicitly. Now, did Arabia in Paul's day have a different meaning or location? I can't say myself because I haven't researched in this and or come to a conclusion. But let me get back to other verses. Paul went into Arabia, and then he returned to Damascus. Remember, when after he was converted, he stayed in Damascus, an area, for quite a while. Then he went to after a number of years after his conversion. Then he went to Jerusalem to those who were apostles. Then he came away into Arabia, and then returned to Damascus without stopping back in Jerusalem, apparently. This is in Galatians 1, chapter 1, verse 17. Galatians 4, verse 25 is where he equates says that Mount Sinai is in Arabia. So that alone gives me a good feeling that, you know, Saudi Arabia is probably where Mount Sinai is. Now, I did ask Dr. Martin about that. Well, and I said, well, this mountain in Saudi Arabia is supposedly called the Mountain of Moses. And he kind of dismissed the idea, and he said, well, a lot of mountains over in that area are called the Mount of Moses for the sake of the tourists. And then there's one traditional best-liked one where the, you know, at what is called Mount Sinai, where they have the monks live, and they have where the monastery is located. So that's become the most famous one, and they found manuscripts there and everything else. Tischendorf did so. That's Appendix 1 of 101 Bible Secrets, and it was a little involved, but it dealt in detail with the Dead Sea.
I've got a question.
Red Sea.
David, in the Old Testament, you know, where Abraham goes to purchase a field for his, you know, for the burial of his wife, And he talked with, is it Arba? A-R-A-B-A? Arba?
Well, I'm there now. He bought it from the Philistines, didn't he?
Yeah.
Field of, I don't see any Arba, but... Oh. Well, Joshua talks about Arba.
Yeah. Okay, I've got it confused.
Yeah, the city of Arba, the father of the Anakim.
Yeah, see, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
These were considered the hybrids, I believe, you know, the Nephilim people. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and actually, which is now, this is in Joshua chapter 21, verse 11, excuse me, and they gave them, let's see, who was it? Oh, the children of Aaron. They gave him the city of Arba, the father of Anak, which city is, the city is now called Hebron.
Yeah.
In the hill country of Judah, with the suburbs thereof around it. But the fields of the city and the villages thereof they gave to Caleb. So, you know, Hebron was actually one of the homes of the Anakim.
Yes.
Original homes. And so was south of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
In the valley where the, I believe it's where the Tyropean and the Valley of Hinnom, where the Tyropean and the Kidron meet. That they also lived in that area.
Yes.
So, but they were gone by the time of David. Now, David didn't kill the last of Goliath. Was not the last of the giants.
That's
there were
right.
There were others, and David's family and mighty men killed them off, and they were generally Philistines, if I believe.
Yeah, but they weren't right. All killed.
Well, you're mixing the Nephilim with the sons of God.
Okay.
Yeah. The Nephilim are the offspring, the physical offspring, who were the giants and the mighty men, like Hercules, you know, had a human mother and a divine father, supposedly.
Yeah.
And whether that's true in Hercules' case, I have no idea. Samson was very strong, did Herculean tasks, but he was entirely human. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, there's another old legend supposed to be in Ginsburg that Keturah, the wife, is it Abraham's second wife, was a descendant of Hercules.
Oh.
Which I thought was kind of interesting.
That might be. I have no idea, but, you know, it's not biblical, so who knows? A lot of that stuff gets brought in, and unless it's biblical and we're reading it correctly, and, you know, as we mentioned before, there's still a lot of terms that are only used once, and they're guessing at the meaning.
Right.
Through etymology, it's relationship to other terms, terms that are used in other languages like Ugaritic and even Assyrian, similarities.
Yeah.
Sometimes they even use Arabic to explain a Hebrew term, which, you know, Arabic is a very late developed language, and yet they have nothing else to go on, so they just take whatever straw they have and try to build, you know, well, that seems to fit until something better comes along, we'll use that translation.
Yeah.
And which is fine. I mean, you have to put something down. In general, sometimes it's better just to, like they do with the term Rephaim. No one really knows what the term means. It seems to have a reference to some type of being, creature, related to the Anakim and the Nephilim, and they all had different terms based on geography. And the Rephaim lived in Jerusalem, south of the citadel,
in
the valley and south of there.
Is there any evidence or proof anywhere except in Ginsberg's legends of the Jews that Jerusalem, one of the very, very early names, was Ariel?
That doesn't ring a bell with me. Okay. There is Isaiah 29:7 talks about that fight against Ariel, which is the name is applied to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And it's referring to Jerusalem. It's a symbolic name, which means, according to the dictionary I'm using, means lion of God or lioness of God. And it's being used by Isaiah in chapter 29 three times, several times actually, to refer to Jerusalem.
Wouldn't that be in the days when the sons of God were operating?
No, this is in Isaiah 29, verse 1. It talks about the siege of Jerusalem.
Okay.
And I believe it's talking about, it could be, let's see, I think this is, I'd have to, I just don't recall right now, but I think this is referring to Hezekiah when the Assyrians came to surround Jerusalem. And, you know, if they didn't shape up, God would take care of them. It probably also has a later, you know, Israel was made the mistake of depending on Egypt to much too great an extent. And that's what the discussion is in Ezekiel 29, generally.
Okay.
So, the commentators seem to believe, at least Matthew Henry, which is the one I have here, seems to understand that it refers to the siege of the Egyptian army against Assyrian army against Jerusalem, but also refers to the later destruction of Jerusalem by the Chaldeans or perhaps even the Romans. There's elements that could be fulfilled. I haven't looked at this in detail.
Okay.
So I can't really say.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah.
I find all these things very fascinating.
Yeah, Ariel is another name for Israel. And then there's a man named Ariel.
Now, wait a minute. Ezra. Ariel is another name for Israel geographic location?
I'm sorry, Jerusalem.
Oh, okay.
Ariel is another, it's kind of like a nickname for Jerusalem.
Hmm.
And it's only used, in four verses. In Ezra, it refers to a man. Hmm. And, of course, Ezra is after the dispersion, and then they returned to Jerusalem. And then in Isaiah chapter 29 is the only other place where it's used. In verse 1, twice, in verse 2, twice, and in verse 7. Why it's used, I don't know. If it's not referred to anywhere else, it's kind of difficult to... the meaning is clear, but the usage is somewhat unclear. So... let's see here. Yeah. That's about all. And you'd have to actually do a referral study to see where this is used in the New Testament. And like I've mentioned before, sometimes where something is fulfilled or mentioned again in another prophecy, say in Revelation, they just use a phrase from the Isaiah passage, say, Isaiah 29.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to know the context. On the larger context, say, of all of Isaiah chapter 29, verses 1 to 16, and yet they're only referred to in the prophecy in Revelation. Revelation is famous for this, where it uses just a small phrase, and the audience is supposed to know the text so well that they're supposed to know that it's talking about those 16 chapters, which then you can insert into the Revelation section. for detail. And that needs to be done by someone. And then a master database, so to speak,
yes,
a prophecy, and then tick things off as they occur. And it's getting easier and easier. It could be done now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, it sure could.
And, you know, how you would do that, I'm not exactly sure. Whether in an Excel, whether a database program or a spreadsheet program or something where you click on a verse and then it all opens up to the right with all the, not just Isaiah, but all the prophecies that refer to that. And then you get a total picture, a three-dimensional picture of any particular event.
Well,
for example, the Antichrist has several names.
Yes.
Well, if you put all those names together, they probably tell a story. And a particular name is used in a particular context for a reason.
Yes, that's right.
Scripture is very detailed, and to a certain extent, prophecy is like a puzzle. And, of course, I'm not interested in setting dates, but there's no reason why we can't determine a sequence of events for, like we've mentioned before, for Iraq, for Babylon, for Jerusalem, for the Christian church, for the Jewish nation, and even separating the Israel from Judah, which will occur at the end time, before the end time again.
You know, another point too, what would be so wonderful about a database like that would be that it would show when these things, many of them have reoccurred throughout history.
Right.
You know, there's many prophecies, you know, people will point to and say, ah, well, that's already been fulfilled. Yeah, a half a dozen times, but there is a last time that these
right.
things will be fulfilled.
Exactly. There's
yeah.
a type and an antitype.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of people think that the Olivet prophecy has been fulfilled. But when you stop to think about it, Christ wasn't just Christ was doing the same thing that I talked about. He was referring to other passages in Scripture.
Right.
But the prophecies that Christ gave were not fulfilled totally in his time. Some were partially fulfilled as a secondary type at the siege and the destruction of Jerusalem by Rome. However, the Romans did not walk into the temple and set up the image of the emperor, like the Antichrist is shown to do. That did not occur. So you can't claim that that was a fulfillment of what Christ was talking about. They destroyed the temple completely. They did not debase it. Well, obviously a destruction is a debasing, but they did not pollute it by doing horrible things, you know, sacrificing pigs. Pompey did that, but he didn't. When Pompey did that and Antiochus did that, they didn't destroy Jerusalem. So they weren't a total fulfillment. So there's sometimes you have a prophecy which goes up right up to a certain point and then stops and then occurs at the end time. Well, how do you figure out which is which? Well, this is, you know, these are God's secrets that it's up to us to figure out. Literally, it's, you know, God conceals a thing and it's the glory of kings, of which we are more than kings. It's the glory of kings to discover them, to work them out. And, you know, why not us and why not now?
Exactly.
And this can be done now. Technologically, there are tools that are unbelievable with BibleWorks and Logos and eSword that you could do this now. And there's plenty of books that can help you. You know, the BibleWorks has a little thing called the Treasury of Scripture Knowledge, all electronic. You click on a verse, and the Treasury of Scripture Knowledge with 100,000 links where the author thinks that it is referred to, and then you can click on the link, and it takes you right to it. Well, a lot of that work has already been done for you in regard to the prophecies because you know, some of these verses, it's obvious. When Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, cites a passage from the Old Testament, it invariably uses the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament. So you have to put the Greek Old Testament meaning and compare it with the Hebrew in many cases, at least in Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, because that's what the Apostle Paul used. And in some cases, he changed the meaning of what everyone thinks the Hebrew says and goes with the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament meaning, which is was well known to the Greeks that were the audience that Paul wrote to in the book of Hebrews. So you have to take all this stuff into account. And then when you encounter single usage terms, you're still stuck with the same problem the translators are stuck with. And that's why they have marginal notes and say, well, it could mean this and it could mean that.
Yeah, exactly.
But as you're going through the events, you would be able to keep track of these and then see which, okay, well, this term means this now. Now, that might clarify other verses. Now, one of the events that has occurred in prophecy is the return of Israel to the land. Some people don't consider the Israel that's there now legitimate, but what determines legitimacy? Well, they don't follow the law of Moses. Well, when did they ever follow the law of Moses?
Good
Let's put it that way.
Good point.
They couldn't follow the law of Moses, so it's a matter of degree and extent and intent. They followed the law of Moses when, Agrippa was king after King Herod. King Herod wasn't even a Jew. He was an Idumean.
Yeah.
So, and we know that the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they gave directives about how the law should be done and conducted. And Christ said, do what they say, don't do what they do, because they're hypocrites. So, but nobody was able to do it at that time. And to a certain extent, what the radical Arabs want to do, which is establish Sharia law in Arabic countries, is exactly what the Pharisees wanted to do and did do to a certain extent in the time of Christ. The law of Moses is a constitution. It's not just a set of religious laws. It governed everything that they did. It set up their law courts as well as their what they should do religiously.
Yes.
It told them literally what they could eat and what they couldn't eat, their relations with non-Jewish people, and it was very strict. If you read Edersheim, Life and Times of Jesus and the Messiah, the less contact they had with non-Israelites and non-Jews, the better, on both sides, because the Jews were so different. And that bred antagonism. There was even that same antagonism in the early church. Great antagonism between Gentile believers and Jewish believers.
Yeah.
Because Jewish believers, we get this in the book of Galatians, because there were Jews from Jerusalem who tried to convince Peter and others not to eat with the Gentiles because of the law of Moses. And they were correct. They were wrong because it was no longer required, and Peter was playing the hypocrite, and the Gentiles were not required to obey the law of Moses. But Peter felt compelled to separate himself from the Gentiles. Now, think about this. How would the Gentiles have felt about this? They would have been rather offended.
Well, sure.
we're not good enough to even eat with these people. And why? Because the Gentiles doing certain things, meat sacrificed to idols, eating pork, there's no way the Jews are going to eat the pork. Of course not. Or mixing meats, or you know, even some of the cleanliness things. Some were ritual cleanliness and some were just common sense health cleanliness rituals and rules and laws. But in general, most of them were ritual, because even the Jews, by today's standards, were not that clean. I mean, that's the way society was. They weren't what today we normally live with sanitation.
Yeah.
They just didn't have it. I mean, they threw things out into the street. Everybody did.
No wonder
they had diseases come through and wipe
out. You could probably go down to Mexico on border town and you would be seeing what it was like back then.
And anywhere in the world except Europe and the United States.
Yeah. And now the American Southwest is being turned into that kind of a thing. You know, filthy, full of diseased people, all kinds of stuff, David. It's really awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that's the way life was. And life was tough. And yet they were, you know, healthy because they lived around it all their lives. And unless something different came along, a different set of bugs, it didn't generally kill them. And people were tougher in those days. We're not as tough today as they were back then. So
that's a good point.
In David's day, you had people running for half a day, and I'm talking about running, not trotting or jogging, running half a day, chasing each other from Dan to Beersheba.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I don't know where that is. I know people who do know where that is, but, you know, and then they'd fight after they were exhausted.
Well, you know, even in very recent times, in the last decade or two, there have been, I admittedly very sparse, but there have been articles about North Africans that are drug runners. And they carry heavy packs on their back, and they run miles and miles, many miles, with these heavy packs of drugs, you know, to deliver them.
All right, where no road can go.
Yeah, and you know, they're very strong people to be able to do that.
Sure, and part of that is training, and you know, doing it all your life, and you know, part of it is the. You know, genetic. You know, and I couldn't do that. I'd be dead after a few miles, if sooner.
I'd be dead after a few yards. My old bones. My gosh.
We're having fun here.
Yeah, we are.
With these questions and these appendices. So the next one is going to be, I'll do it next time, not this time, the error of the long-haired Jesus. And this, I'll give you a preview and we'll discuss this, but, you know, one of the biggest blunders that Hollywood has made is depiction of Jesus having long hair. And Dr. Martin says in this article that Jesus did not even have a beard. And then someone wrote me and cited the fact that, you know, it says right here in this verse that Jesus had a beard. It was an Old Testament verse, and we'll cover this next time. But then I looked in the New Testament in any translation I could find, and of course it's a lot easier to do this electronically now. There is no word in the New Testament for the word beard.
Wow.
There is no, and it's not translated anywhere, not in the Greek, not even in the Greek, nor is there a word for beard, at least in the index, of Danby's Mishnah. Now, obviously it makes references to it in the Old Testament, but the Mishnah generally refers to New Testament era, you know, Second Temple, items. So, you know, the idea of the verse was referring to Jesus' beard being plucked out. Well, if Jesus, the alternate translations are that Jesus was slapped. And that makes more sense because this verse is cited as being fulfilled. And it doesn't talk about the beard in the Greek New Testament passage. It talks about Jesus being slapped.
Slapped
on the face.
Oh, okay.
So there's a mistranslation there. And, you know, in the King James, in the NIV, that this person cited. So, you know, and we'll get into this next time. But there's different avenues of research. And I thought, well, you know, he might be right. Let's look into this. But when I looked at everything, that's not a King James-ism in this case, but it's, you know, the NIV and actually the modern translations are incorrect in this case, which was very interesting.
Yeah, very.
So,
well, what in those days when men had long hair and a beard, weren't they considered pagan? That was the pagan...
Right.
Okay. Well, look today.
Now, they had beards in the Old Testament. I mean, that's not a problem. But in the New Testament and in the temple, there was no long hair because it was forbidden. God specifically says you're supposed to have short hair. Now, what did they consider to be short hair in those days? I don't know. But we know you go to, you know, any website that talks about Roman art and look at the hairstyles of the Romans, the men, and it's all short hair and clean shaven.
Right.
It was the barbarians in Northern Europe. And, you know, Paul himself says it's a shame for a man to have long hair.
Right.
And now, for particular periods of mourning, and when you had a Nazarite vow, you had to let your hair grow. Hmm. But you could not enter the tabernacle or the temple.
Or the temple, yeah.
Because God insisted on short hair.
Well, that wasn't for women also, correct?
No, women are supposed to have long hair.
Yeah.
According to Paul. And some have said, well, that's just a cultural thing. But women, of course, could only go to the court of the women in the temple.
Yeah.
And the court of Israel. So, you know, they had a restriction also. And only the priests could go into the holy place. So, you know, it's an interesting subject in itself, but it does appear that, you know, the entities that appear to people many times with long hair, that's a definite clue and a giveaway that you're dealing with, you know, occultic or demonic evil spirits.
Well, you know, I've heard over time, David, oh my gosh, many people, you know, claim that they've had some kind of near-death experience, for example, and they see this Jesus, and they'll describe him with long hair and
right.
beard, or people that have claimed out-of-body experiences, and they have actually encountered Jesus with long hair and a
That's
beard.
Right.
You know, see, I think... there's something funny about that. They're not encountering Jesus Christ.
Ellen G. White, same thing.
Oh, her. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and you see it in the, you know, I used to see it all the time when I went to Lutheran church and catechism when I was, you know, teenager and a young boy, mm-hmm. you know, they had them all over the place. Well, what does it say in, you know, Exodus and Deuteronomy in the Torah? It says no graven images. And these are people who felt that, you know, Jesus was part of the Trinity.
Yeah.
But they got pictures of him, they got statues of him, and, you know, the Catholics are worse, and the Greek Orthodox are the worst of all.
Goodness.
Just horrible. You know, more than the Buddhists and the worse than the, you know, any pagan you can imagine. And I might as well offend the Russian Orthodox also. Because, you know, but that's the way it is. It's just we do exactly the opposite of what we're commanded.
You know, that in itself would be a very interesting study.
Yeah.
Why human beings are like that. You
right.
Know, it's strange. Mm.
Yeah, it's a proclivity. And so, well, I don't know whether, for some people it's probably, you can't tell me what to do. And
yeah.
For others it's just, oh, but it's, you know, I don't mean it that way. I mean it this way. Well, they go do exactly the opposite of what's commanded.
Right.
Or I'm the exception, or God will understand.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they do this all the time with Christmas, or it's just, you know, I'm being all things to all people like the Apostle Paul. Well, that didn't mean that the Apostle Paul sinned.
Yeah.
Or, you know, promoted a pagan holiday because he wanted to, you know, preach to the Gentiles. He never compromised.
Right.
He never had to.
Right.
And he still was able to get his message across. Of course, he was beaten and killed several times, but that's another point.
That's another issue. Oh, dear.
The point is he didn't compromise.
Well, and I'm sure God took note of that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, David, I'm telling you, this gets into some very interesting material, and I really enjoy these audio files because I learn a lot of things. And there are a lot of secrets in the Bible that we don't know yet.
Right.
You know, and as time passes, more and more things are becoming, you know, we're finding out more. And it is really, really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's nothing on this planet, to me anyway, that is more exciting than learning and watching these things unfold.
And some people learn better by reading and some
yeah.
people by listening. So,
right.
You know, the more avenues we can provide to teach and eventually get them into the book, it's definitely necessary to get into the scriptures.
Right.
But, you know, it's nice to go in with some understanding and background in a lot of these things.
Darn right.
So that when you read it, it says, oh, well, that makes perfectly good sense.
Yeah.
So,
and you said something earlier that is absolutely correct. Hollywood, being a pagan, shall we call it, institution in itself, has done a lot of harm in their presentations. For example, what we started with here, the crossing of the Red Sea. Here they have, you know, the movie about that, and the sea just, you know,
mm-hmm.
rolling up on each side. I believe God works within the natural laws that he has set down. We may not know yet, and I'm sure we don't, all of those natural laws.
Right.
I think there's a level of physics that we're barely, barely glimpsing even now, and a lot more to be learned.
Well, our whole physics and science is based on particles.
Yes.
And is it possible to have a science based on essentially waves?
Yes.
Which would be more akin to music.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Whereas you use music to manipulate things and objects. I don't know. There's some tantalizing hints in reports and books and things that if you, you know, establish somehow the wavelength of an object, it becomes essentially weightless or considerably weighs less.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I've been looking at this, not enough to research it, but, you know, I've been noticing things like that as in my studies over the years. And I don't know, but ancient culture was able to do sophisticated metallurgy. They could have produced wheels and you know, a lot sooner. They knew about the steam engine, and it doesn't take a genius to apply the power of a steam engine with gears and make the wheels move. But, you know, and the excuse has been, well, they had slaves, they didn't need animals or mechanical efficiency. But if it would have given them military advantage, they certainly would have done it. Now, perhaps they didn't need it. You know, there's been several websites that talked about the Egyptians did not carve. They carved some of the stones for the pyramids, but they poured the rest, like a concrete, into molds. Well, I don't know. I haven't been there. I don't know enough about, you know, that they were able to pour limestone. Could be. I don't know. But, or another thing, that they were able to lift them with sound somehow. I've read several reports of people being able to do that in a certain chanting. Well, who knows? Maybe they had to do it with demons or evil spirits to assist them.
Yeah.
I just don't know. Or maybe it's a natural phenomena that we just we discovered in ancient times and was lost. I attended a lecture of in Portland here about a Greek ship that was transporting, it had sunk and off the coast of Turkey, and they were transporting these huge drums of columns for what do they call these columns?
I don't know.
You know, for temples, the things that stand up on the temples, pillars.
Pillars, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, like around the Parthenon and things like that. And that's still not the right term. But in any case, these things weighed several tons, huge, massive things, and they were positioned very carefully on the ship, of course, to distribute the weight and everything else. And they don't know how they were able to carve them, because they carved them in blocks that they would set on one on top of another, but they don't exactly know how they got them on the boat. And today they were looking to lift these things and move them underwater using air-filled balloons, and they still had very great difficulty doing that with today's technology. And using air-filled balloons and everything else, you know, to for buoyancy and to lift these drum columns, these column drums. And then when they were set on top of each other, each of these drums would taper toward the top in with ridges in perfect alignment, and so that you wouldn't know the difference that this was made in section.
Yeah.
It would appear like the ones in the Parthenon as one solid piece when they're actually in sections. Some are more visible depending on the workmanship, but some you can't even tell that they were sliced in pie shapes, like not pie shapes, but pie sections, like drums. And so there's still mysteries that we don't know. How did they get those things onto the boat? You know, how did they get them to the dock and get them on the boat and then get them off and then transport them to where apparently this was a shipment of drum columns that were going to Egypt, because it was an Egyptian who was carrying Greek columns during the time of the Ptolemies after Alexander the Great. So. You know, there's all sorts of mysteries. I highly recommend a book by Sprague de Camp called The Ancient Engineers. It's in most all libraries. It's a wonderful book. It shows how they did these things. The book is about 30 years old, but it's still just mechanics. And it shows how they did marvelous things, but there are some things that we don't know how they did them. They had a program on on the History Channel the other day about great discoveries on how they transported on these super ships these 500-ton obelisks. Well, it's fine once they got it on the boat, but how did they get it on the boat?
That's right. How did they do that?
You can't just drop these things and lay them out. You know, did they finish building the boat after the things were on board and then make them somehow seaworthy? Now, they didn't have to go very far, but and they were huge structures. First of all, they had to support 500 tons, so the boat had to be at least, you know, given buoyancy and all that, massive in itself. And you know what they did? It was revealed in one Egyptian boat that they discovered under the Giza Sphinx.
Yes.
And they have it in display. They reinforced the joints with rope. And when the rope got wet, it expanded and
right.
filled in the spaces in between the, you know, where there might be a separation in the wood planks. Just unbelievably remarkable, the things that were able to be done. So,
do you have any, has anyone ever mentioned what they made rope out of in those days?
Oh, it was made out of hemp and flax and everything.
Yeah, that's why they don't want us to have hemp rope anymore.
Well, hemp actually would be an ideal alternative to
the cotton.
The fuel.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a clothing, but also instead of, what do they call it? They make fuel out of corn?
They call it green fuel, biofuel.
Biofuel, yeah.
Yeah.
Hemp would be perfect for that. And, of course, it wouldn't be marijuana because hemp is completely different.
Yeah.
And you can breed it. But hemp grows in 90 days. You can get a complete crop of hemp, which is also good for the soil, in 90 days. How long does corn take to grow? I don't know.
3 months or so. Or
yeah.
More.
Yeah.
You know, I have a pair. I'm very lucky. I have a pair of hemp jeans. And a,
really?
You know, yeah, and a hemp, they call it a driver's shirt. It's, you know, it has three or four buttons in the front. It's long sleeve, very soft. And I've had those for many years, and they look brand new.
Yeah.
Even though I wear them all the time. The hemp clothing, just, it doesn't wear out.
Right, and that's why you don't. So much of it.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah, well, they probably arrest you. I should come in.
Oh, no.
You know, well, they get real sensitive. You try to. I heard of somebody trying to take a bottle of shampoo through customs that it listed on the ingredients. One of the ingredients was hemp oil, you know. And customs, oh, my God, you can't take that through. That's
really?
That's contraband. You know, I mean, these people are insane, you know.
Well, you can go to the health food store and all sorts
sure.
of hemp products. Are,
yeah, hemp oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It's good for your skin.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a crazy world we live in.
No and fooling in it.
That's a muddle through.
It's just getting crazier by the moment. Oh, well, David C. Love, God bless you, and I really enjoy our kibitzing that we do at the end of these files. It's very enlightening stuff, and you answer a lot of my questions, and I thank you again for putting up with me.
Always a pleasure.
Oh, dear.
Great joy.
Thank you. And everybody, we've been working on this series, 101 Bible Secrets. Right now, this ends file number 18. File number 19 will be all about the long-haired Jesus and the error of portraying him in that way. And this book that we're talking about, 101 Bible Secrets, is free to read online at askelm.com, askelm.com. So go there, follow along, get it, read it, follow along with the audio files we're doing. You can also email David Seeloff, david@askelm.com. And if you enjoy these audio files, please email David Seeloff and let him know if you're learning and if you appreciate what you're learning. That's good manners. Anyway, this is George Ann Hughes with David Seeloff signing off. God bless everybody out there listening. And God willing, we'll be back. God bless you too, David Seeloff.
Thank you, George Ann, and bless you for the work that you've been doing.
I thank you. Good night, everybody. God bless.